Hello, all my lovelies, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This week, my guest is truly formidable and she tells so many stories this week. Honestly, it kind of defies description. I can't even encapsulate this human being in one little intro like this, but I'm going to read a little bit from her website so you know what you're in for. Her website is nomadicare.org. And so from her website, it says, in 1994, Sass Carey, RN, traveled for the first time to Mongolia, where she discovered her life's passion, working with the nomadic people who inhabit the rugged landscape of that area. Drawing on her nursing background, she was first led to work with them in the area of healthcare, which was severely lacking. So she's worked with the nomads and the reindeer herders for over two decades and has a very close relationship with them. She founded Nomadicare in 2010 as a nonprofit in order to gather support and resources so she could continue her work in healthcare and documentation. Because she's created multiple documentary films about different aspects of the nomadic and reindeer herders' lives. But she's also written multiple books about them, about their lives, about their traditions, and especially about their shamanic practitioners. Sass shares multiple stories about those travels and those encounters with the nomads and with the reindeer herders. And this episode is so profound and so interesting. And I just was sitting on the edge of my seat while having my conversation with her. So without further ado, here is Sass Carey and my interview and conversation about her travels in Mongolia.
I had that happen once. Somebody, a shaman once sang my song for me. I didn't know it was my song. He sang it and I was just crying. And I said, that was the most beautiful song I ever heard. And he said, that's because it's your song. And I was like, oh. The most important thing is that I'm a spirit in a human body. You know, I mean, that's kind of cliche, but you know, I believe you come in here and you have certain things that you're made to do. You can either ignore them or listen carefully to your meditation and do them. So I've tried to do them, and it's just one miracle after another, because once you have that contract with the spirit takes care of you. I really feel taken care of. And I just keep doing these crazy things like going to Mongolia, you know? So, okay, whatever you want.
I mean, that was something I just found so intriguing and profound on your website. And I am a huge fan of adventure and kind of seeing the edge of the cliff and then taking a step off and, you know, crossing fingers and toes that you'll be taken care of and things will end up okay. And on your website, you know, you talk about Mongolia and the adventures and work that you've done there. How did that even come about? How was that a possibility in your world?
It's just unbelievable, really, when I think back at it. You know, I became a Quaker 60 years ago. And so I learned to listen carefully to the inner voice, and the inner voice, and also to other people, you know, when other people say something and listening to them. And so one day I was doing an energy healing on a friend of mine, and she said, You know, I just read this book, Encounters with Chi, by David Eisenberg from Harvard. And I think you should go to China because you've been working with energy for all these years. And I said, I read that book. It's very interesting, isn't it? And she said, yes, I think you should go to China. And I said, I don't have any money. And she said, well, how many sessions would it be? And we traded 7 years of energy healing, and I got to go to China and Mongolia. Yeah, that's how it happened. I know. It's just unbelievable. So first I went to China and we went touring, you know, with the I was with the American Holistic Nurses Association, and then, which was also guided, and then we went to Mongolia for a week. I stepped off this plane. It didn't have tarmac yet. It was just ground. I stepped on the ground and the energy came up through my feet, like, and I knew something was up, and I just totally fell in love with it. So the next thing that happened was that at that trip, we were touring a traditional medicine center, and it came to me like in Quaker meeting, my heart starts pounding and then I'm supposed to speak. And I said to this doctor who was a traditional medicine doctor and a you know, Soviet trained in Western medicine and a traditional Mongolian medicine doctor, I said, would you take an American disciple? I mean, I don't talk like that, you know, I mean, and he said, yes. So the next year I went, and one of my friends who was on the first tour too went with me, and we became the first two Westerners to be trained in traditional Mongolian medicine. It's an amazing system. And at first I thought, oh yeah, I can bring it into Western medicine. It's its own whole piece. They're two separate things. You can use both, but you can't mix them because it comes from a totally different direction. Like Western medicine believes in healing the part of the body that's sick, okay? And if that happens, then the whole body will heal. Eastern medicine believes you take care of the whole body and then the little part that's off balance will heal. So that's why you can use both, but you can't say, oh, I'll take that medicine and use it with Western medicine. So we had 3.5 months of sitting every day with this doctor, the two of us. It was outrageous, you know. I really had no clue what was going on. I couldn't wrap myself around it. It was just, I thought, maybe I'm getting this by osmosis. I mean, the spirit told me to come here. You know, we just sat every day and took notes. I have like a whole big notebook of every word he said, you know. So then we went out to the countryside with him to learn about herbs and medicines. And people came from all around for him to do healing on him and to do treatments, because he was this really well-known doctor, Dr. Boltsaihin. Yeah. And so I saw these gares and people living in them with the horses and, you know, just the lifestyle. And I thought, this looks like a movie set. I can't believe it's happening today. So one of the next leadings I got, we call it leadings, callings in Quaker. So one of the next leadings I got was to make movies, make a movie about Mongolia and Mongolian women. My first movie is Gobi Women's Song. And the reason that came through in meditation was I found out they use 5 liters of water a day for everything. That's like a gallon and a quart for drinking, cooking, cleaning, washing, everything. And that was coming to me in the meditation, like, we are not living a sustainable life in the U.S. You know, in fact, that was in the 90s. One flush of the toilet was way more than these people used in one day. So I thought, oh, I should make a movie. Or I said, you should make a movie. I had no idea how to make a movie. I've taken pictures, you know, but I got a few names from people because I wanted it to be a woman's movie with a woman team crew. I called this one woman who was supposed to be a translator. And she said, well, I can't really translate, but my boyfriend is an American and he's from New York and he's a camera person. And he might be willing to join you. He's here to make another movie. And I got on the phone with him and he said, well, I'm a guy, but I don't think that'll get in the way. And he was so fabulous. I mean, he taught me so much about making a movie. And we went down to the Gobi for 10 days. So then the next thing was I needed a translator. And I remembered this woman I had met the year before. And I called her and I said, I mean, just as I was going to bed, I thought, oh, yeah. And I called her and she said, well, I can't go because I'm really busy, but my daughter could go with you. Her daughter was 19 years old. I knew her daughter. Her name was Haluna. And she spoke great English because she had been a student in New Hampshire for a year. And at present, she works at the U.S. Embassy. I mean, she's fabulous, you know. So she came with us. She was 19 years old. So we met these, people, friends of friends that introduced us to everybody. They introduced us to the doctor. And the SUM director, that means the county director, gave us five names of women that we could interview in the countryside who were nomadic herders and who were single women. And so we used all those women to, and then we met the doctor in the hospital, the local hospital. And she said, oh, well, we have births here. And there's a woman right now living in the birth center. And I said, well, could we meet her? And they said, yeah, sure. So we go over and meet her. She's a nomadic herder. This is her third child. She spends a whole day in her life, every day of her life, milking horses, milking goats. And that was great. I said, we made a connection because every day I would talk to her. Then I said, would you be willing to let us come to your birth? She said, yes. So the birth is on the first movie. Her birth, which is Gobi women's song. I mean, of course you have to, I mean, that's what we do. We can give birth, you know, that's what makes one thing that makes us really unique. I really had no idea how to make a movie, but it happened.
I just said, I love that because, you know, there's a few different pieces there of having this trip and going on this trip, which is facilitated by someone really unexpectedly and kind of, you know, I'm sure your jaw just dropped and you thought, what? And then to go out and, you know, get all this knowledge also from this traditional doctor that you didn't expect. You know, it's like when you left for China and you left for this trip, there was no idea of what would be entering into your life. And I think that's what's so exciting and really fabulous about taking a chance and stepping out your front door and going on the adventure. Oh my gosh, Robert Frost said, you know, the road less traveled, and that road has made all the difference. Yeah. I'm just really intrigued before we go too much further. You have referenced that, you know, you do this energy work and right. That you work on people and you have these leadings. So how did that come about? Did you have this as a child or how did this surface, this ability or this idea that you wanted to heal people?
I went to a psychic in 1974 to ask about a family situation. And the first thing she said was, you're a healer. I didn't know what a healer was. And so I just started looking into what a healer might be. And she said I was going to start an Edgar Cayce study group, which is, yeah. So we did that for 3 years. Every week we did the name of his book is Search for God. which I don't usually use the word God because, you know, it doesn't feel comfortable to me. I grew up as a congregational person, and now I'm Quaker, and I say spirit. So anyway, but we did a lot of exercises and different kind of psychic things. And I also had a workshop with someone about, I had therapeutic touch workshop, and I had a couple other workshops, but mostly it was all about listening and following what message I get. And the reason I like to use this as an example is because everybody's life is rich when they listen and do what they're here for. And the time it was tested the most was when I later started working with the Duha reindeer herders in the northern part of Mongolia in the taiga. Had to ride a horse 8 hours and didn't know how to ride. I was never so scared in my entire life. I was just terrified. And I just kept envisioning my Quaker meeting, all my friends, everybody, the spirit, everything holding me to keep me alive. I was just, you know, my knees kept bumping into trees and I didn't know how to lead the horse. I didn't know how to do anything, really. I was just up there. Okay, you want me to ride a horse 8 hours? Okay, sure. But woo, that was a tough one. Yeah. And I got so connected to the reindeer herders. They're 300 in this group. It's called the Duha Reindeer Herders. They came from Tuva. And they still live the way their ancestors lived. They live in orts or teepee, Siberian teepee. It's 40 below sometimes in the winter, and they have like canvas between them and the outside. And I just fell in love with those people and started a lot of other projects from that. First of all, we discovered they had bleeding gums, so we started taking them vitamin C, and we took them each one a year supply of vitamin C since 2003 up till now, to 2024. That's a long time. And then we started taking them hygiene kits and, you know, other things. And because I was there so often, I went every year. I went to Mongolia 20 times in 30 years. And they totally trust me. And I could take a picture of anything. And where they don't really like being photographed. But so I've made 3 movies up there in the taiga, you know, one in the Gobi, which is in southern Mongolia, and then one is in the north, just about the border of Russia. And they're just fabulous, you know. So the second one was ceremony about shamans. I interviewed 15 shamans and went to about 15 ceremonies and just kind of put that together, 15 different peoples. And then the next one was called Migration, because I went back to the Gobi and met with the women who were in my movie and found out that none of them were nomads in that short time, from 2001 to 2013. They weren't. And I know this is why I was guided to do this whole project and the movies, because people said that that way of life was at risk. And, you know, so we wanted to get it documented. And then I realized the reindeer herders were still migrating. So I think it was 2014, I went up and I migrated with them. That was a little challenging too. I rode a reindeer for 2 days to the different, you know, to the summer camp. Yeah. And I really like riding a reindeer better than a horse, let me tell you. I mean, they're lower, so when you fall, you don't hurt as much and those kind of things, you know. So that movie, Migration, that movie is now being shown on the Mongolian International Airline on the plane, so that when people go to Mongolia, they get, or come back from Mongolia, they see the movie of the lifestyle of the nomads. So that makes me feel so blessed.
I
I wanted to just ask, you referenced early on when you were speaking about growing up, I think you said as a Congregationalist.
Yeah.
And then you came to Quakerism. And I'm so curious, how did that happen? And also, I think for my listeners, it would be really interesting to hear, you know, what you referenced earlier, which was getting your heart beating quickly and then speaking in the meetings. I'd love to have more of an explanation of that.
Okay, sure. So the first part is, it was during the Vietnam War, the beginning of the Vietnam War, and this person I was marrying in 1964, he was a Congregational to begin with too, and some of the people in his church were on his draft board, and he said, how can they do that? You know, how can you fight and kill people if you're a Christian, if you're Congregational? So he found the Quakers were pacifists, and he convinced me really pretty fast. I mean, makes a lot of sense. So we both became Quakers when we got married in 64. So the second thing about how do you speak, you know, if you just get into that really deep place and you connect with the spirit, that's why they're called Quakers, is because they quake. And that means there's something that's trying to come through. And so for me, my heart just starts like pounding like this. And then I know I'm supposed to say something. I hold back. You know, you hold back, you wait like three times. There are lots of little things like that. But basically, it's a body indication that there's something that's trying to come through.
I, you know, I'm nervous about speaking in front of people. So I can't imagine being in a meeting and worshiping with a bunch of people and then feeling like I had to say something. I don't know if I would have the guts to do it. Was that ever an issue for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it really doesn't. It's not a good thing to hold back. It's just you learn it's just not a good thing to hold back. It's just, you know, it's part of what you're here for. It's just like everything else of doing what you're told to do. That's one of the things, you know, you're actually holding out on somebody else who needs to hear it. That's what I learned.
That is a good way to think about it. Thank you for that, because I've really been questioning voice and how to use voice with integrity and authenticity and what's real for my heart or true for my heart. But also, I really do think about the words I use are true path or right path. And, you know, there is a sense that I've done all this before. Sure. And so it's like every time I live this life, I have to find the path, the right path where I'm supposed to be, so that I can show up for other people or organizations or even for myself in a way that furthers the growth and the beauty in this universe and this, you exactly. know, in this reality. And so I think about that, I'm not obsessed with it, but I do, you know, when I make a choice or I make a decision, I say, does this feel right? Like really what I say is, does it feel familiar? Is this something I've done before? And then mm-hmm. when I get that sense, oh, yes, this is the road. I've done this before. I'm just like, all right, I guess I'm going to do the same thing again, but I don't feel bad about it. I have a tattoo on my back that says Amor Fati, which means to be in love with one's own fate. And I talked with Shabana about it, that for quite a long time, I was really, really angry with the knowledge that, you know, that it felt like I'd lived this life before and that I was supposed to show up in certain places to help others or help the world or whatever. And I got really resentful and angry about it, because I also felt that if I didn't show up and help those other people, I was going to get cancer. It was like, this is the way to do it. Yep. But then underneath it, I have, I aim to misbehave. So it's meant to remind Amor Fati. Yes, there are fated events that I'm supposed to show up, but in between I can misbehave a little bit. So both free will and fate.
That's great. I do feel like I misbehave quite a bit, but it's a good thing.
Yeah. Two thumbs up to the misbehaving. So thanks for letting me kind of talk on there a little bit, because it really was I had this dream that was really, really powerful. I don't even know how long ago, but it really it was disturbing because it was so potent and so, I mean, I say it was also unwelcome. Like it really was unwelcome. Cause I was like, I don't want this knowledge. And now you've like ruined everything. And I mean, it was short. I was floating out in the universe and in front of me was pitch black, but with stars. It was like everything. It was the void filled with everything. And I was just marveling at its beauty. And this figure came on and said, Oh, you think that's real? Let me show you what's real. And it reached down to the bottom and pulled the universe back. And behind the universe was, you can't use words. My heart would have exploded, and to say that it was love is like the most ridiculous thing to ever suggest, because it was more than that. It was like all things. It was everything. It was every possibility, I woke up and that was in my room. My entire room was full of that energy. And then I was like, well, this sucks, because as time went on, I realized that it was, this isn't real. And then I'm stuck here, and that I wanted to be in that place. I didn't want to be here. And there, you know, I always talk about this, and I hope it's not upsetting for you, followed like 2 years of me just being like, I don't know what the point is of me being here, because I don't want to at this point. And by the way, F off for giving me that information, because you've totally like broken my heart. And I'm really angry about it. I mean, I was so angry for so long. And then I went to go see an acupuncturist who also does a bunch of other healing. And finally, I told him what I was going through. And he was like, all right, Kirsten. I mean, he's so pragmatic. He's like, all right. Well, you're not going to commit suicide. We're going to figure this out and we're going to fix it because you have work to do. And I was like, oh, I hate you. But it's like sometimes those revelations are very unwelcome, and
yes,
they're disturbing. Yeah. And they can just be heartbreaking. I guess heartbreaking is the only word I can use. Like that knowledge is not, even now I'm like, I don't like that knowledge, because it's like, it's a little bit like it's haunting me.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah.
That's my story. That's one of my stories. So, you know, all these people, it's so interesting to me. I mean, I find it fascinating that there are all these people who now self-style as gurus and shamans in the United States or wherever, you know. And I always think to myself, look, like if you, nobody who's real wants to be that. That's why it's like you actively run away from being a guru or a shaman because you know it's going to like suck, and it's going to be lonely, and it's going to be horrible. Yeah. And, you know, I'm just like, I mean, that's part of your path, I guess, for them to self-proclaim that they're this. But in reality, this mantle, I guess you could say, it's not fun, and it's not supposed to be a party 24/7. It's actually horrible. So I don't know if you feel the same way.
Yeah, all the shamans I met, I mean, no one would ever say they were a shaman, for one thing. You know, they would never, if they said they were a shaman, I would say, you're okay, I don't need to interview you, because they don't say it. You know, they don't want it. They've done everything to not be that person, but they don't have any choices. Yeah. Yeah, I've interviewed a lot of people and, you know, some young people. Like I remember sitting at a restaurant in the city of Ulaanbaatar with this young woman, probably about 20. She said, you know, they've come to me. They've told me I have to, you know, or the energy comes to me and they've told me I'm a shaman and I need to go and have this training, whatever, that really hard stuff that they do. And she said, you know, I really like to drink, so I'm not going to do that. Maybe later, but right now I'm just going to party, you know? And I thought, interesting. You know, they have a different kind of concept of it in Mongolia because they're very familiar. Most people have many people have a shaman in the family who takes care of the family. And so it's not a wanted job, really.
I mean, I would say we need more people like that in the world to help us heal a collective level, you know.
Right.
But I think one of the most, I don't know, things, little gremlins that I fight with too is hubris. It's in whatever. So there's a difference between being proud of something you've accomplished and then getting drunk with power and rampaging through the village. It's a slippery slope and it's difficult, but I really appreciate you saying that the shamans don't call themselves shamans. I think that's a big
never
sign. Yeah.
I mean, they might say, I'm going to do a ceremony tonight. I don't think they even called a ceremony. I'm going to do a something tonight. I forgot what they call it, but you know, we're going to have a something tonight, but they don't know. They wouldn't say I'm a shaman. And you can see it in my movie, Ceremony. It's on Vimeo. That's a movie that Shabana edited for me.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm so scared of watching it because I think I'm going to have serious heartache about wanting to experience what you experienced.
Well, this will give you a little taste of it.
Okay.
Sharing it.
Thank you. I'm excited. Okay. I feel like I can be brave enough. I feel like I can be brave.
It's pretty mild. It's very mild. The beginning is talking about different aspects, and then one person does a ceremony. And then the next year we went back and we interviewed him and said, okay, what's happening here? What's happening here? What's happening now? And we asked other shamans too, like, what's going on? He's coming in. Oh, he's going out. Oh, he's, you know, oh, he just became a wolf. And, you know, like, you really, when you're at a ceremony, you have no, I'm not that culture, you know, so I have no idea what's going on. But the other shamans, even if they aren't of the same exact lineage or ethnic group, They know what's going on.
What was one of the more beautiful things you saw in Mongolia?
Oh, wow. Oof. I think the way the community works. They're in the East Taiga. There are 11 families or 21, 11 families, I think. There are 300 people altogether in the East and West Taiga. They're two separate groups. And so they all live in teepees. So when you ride the horse in, first you see the reindeer, which is just amazing. And then you see all the teepees or orts on the against the mountains. The mountains are beautiful. The land is beautiful. But then when you just stay there and hang out, they just go from one or two or the other. And like the men are out in the pasture, nomading, being herders with the animals. And the women, you know, they're like, they have a crank sewing machine and they make things and they fix the drum for the shaman or, you know, but they all work together. And it's almost like, they all hear the same note, I would say. They're just so harmonious with each other. I'm not saying they don't argue or get angry or, you know, all that kind of stuff, but they just are so connected and connected with their horses and reindeer also, and the land. You know, the land, according to them, has spirits. So this space, this river has this spirit. They have names for the river spirits and name for the mountain spirits, and they're just, everything is connected. I think that's the thing that's most beautiful to me.
Yes, I think that is absolutely such a gorgeous way of being, and to like, to every day, wake up, live your day, go to sleep, dream, just knowing that you're part and parcel. You're like one cog in this gorgeous machinery of like the rivers can be your friends, the clouds can be your friends. I mean, it's just a more, I don't know, it's a more gorgeous way of being, frankly, because who doesn't want to have a river who's a friend or a tree? Yeah, right. You know, it's yeah. it's just to feel that you are part of something that's so beautiful, I think can be such a gorgeous thing for your heart and your soul to yes. comprehend.
Yeah. And so, I think I opened this movie with Ceremony. It's funny, we keep going back to that one, but Sanja, I'm talking to him, and he says, the way you walk on the earth is how the spirits know who you are. Like, as your feet touch the earth, they know exactly who you are.
I think that's beautiful, because just yesterday I went for a walk in the park and I brought a little bag and I picked up garbage. So I think I maybe got a few points yesterday. I mean, it's not entirely altruistic, because my mom said, why do you go to that park all the time and walk in that circle? And I said, that's why I pick up the garbage, because it makes it more like a treasure hunt and it makes it more exciting. Plus, I actually do have this thing about picking up garbage when I go places. It's like this, not an obsession close to it, but I just think to myself, you know, why isn't anybody else picking up garbage? And I want to make this world more beautiful. And if this is like a small way I can do it, then I'm.
My mother always did that. My mother always picked up garbage wherever she walked. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like an easy act. You know what yeah. I mean? You still get your walk.
Yeah.
You know, you're making the world beautiful. So, well, I would love to hear any and all stories that you have to share about anything magical or miraculous you may have participated in or witnessed or just embodied in your life. I'd like to hear anything. I have plenty of time, so please don't feel rushed. Okay. I'd like to hear whatever you have to share.
Okay. Oh, you know, every single thing, like the movie, I've also written two books, and it was the same thing. Just here it is.
I love that.
My latest book is called Marrying Mongolia. It's about how everything that I did, like I was a hippie in the 60s, and I lived in a tent while we built a house on some land in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. So we lived without electricity and running water and telephone then. And I had a home birth in the house that we built. So on and on, you know, my whole life has been this way. But it seems like everything that has happened, and I've done so many different things. Like I've done pottery, I've been a teacher, I've been a nurse, I've been a healer. All that stuff has fed into what I needed to do in Mongolia, because those people are so holistic. You know, they're not breaking down. When you live, when you're a herder and nomadic herder, you're not breaking down the parts. You know, you're not, it's all connected. That's what I said in the beginning. The connection is so important. And so I needed everything. I need everything when I go there, because everything, you know, they're used to everything being connected. I don't know why. I just got this vision of my first movie, Gobi Women's Song. The second year I went to shoot that movie, we went into the people's land where they lived and took care of the animals. And it was like 100 degrees, seriously, no shade, no nothing. And they were making felt on the ground in the Gobi Desert. So they would collect all this wool from the sheep, and they had a piece of canvas underneath on the ground, and they would each take a clump of put it down and pat it next to each other, overlapping. It was about as big as, it was about 15 by 15 feet big, and the whole community was doing this. Then they pour water over it and pat it down more. And then they put another piece of canvas on the top. They rolled it up and tied it together. So it was a big round thing about this big. And they pulled it in back of a camel for a couple hours. Because for felt, you need to have heat you need to have water and you need to have agitation. And just watching them do that, I could barely be there 5 minutes. It was so hot, but they did it. It was great. I mean, I don't know why I just came up with that, but that was just a picture that I, whew, just that picture of them putting it down, just the men and the women, the whole community putting it down and creating this puffy little thing and putting water on it. And anyway, yeah, that's just sort of an image that gives you a sense of how they work together.
I'm so curious, when you were shooting, I'm only bringing this up because, are you familiar with Molly Domasome?
No.
Okay. He wrote this gorgeous book called Of Water and the Spirit. It is just astonishing. And he was, I mean, the short story is he was abducted when he was about 6 or 7 from his village in Africa and raised by Jesuit priests. And so he escaped when he was about 19, made his way back to the village on foot, and they wouldn't accept him because he hadn't gone through the initiation.
Sure.
And so he had to go through this initiation in which boys died because it was so rigorous. And so he says in the book, you know, I'm going to try my, he passed away last year. He's like, I'm going to try my hardest to explain what this initiation looked like and the places we went, because they're not here. They're not in this reality, but like words are not sufficient. So it was, he's written several books. They're all gorgeous. But one of the things he talked about was before he was born, the women, when his mother was heavily pregnant and about to give birth to him within a few weeks, they all went into the woods and they all started singing. And the village women came up with his individual song of him and who he was. And through that song kind of sang to the fetus and let the fetus know who was going to be, what the community was that was going to be receiving the baby and potentials for the baby's life, who the baby could be, which I thought was such a gorgeous and beautiful image. And I thought, oh my goodness, every baby should be welcomed into the world in that way. And so when you were talking about the movie you were making with the women, did they engage in that same?
No. One thing that happened was, you know, the Soviets kind of had their thumb on Mongolia from 1920 to 1990. And when I was making the movie, the Gobi Women's Song, it was just 2000. So they were all brought up in the Soviet time, and they had lost a lot of their culture, especially the people in the Gobi had lost a lot of their culture. But that's why I was taking movies of up in the taiga, because they held on to their culture. I don't know if they did that when they didn't do it to the baby. It was in a hospital, but they were all women. There was a woman doctor, a woman assistant, woman nurse, and us, three of us, translator and camera person and me. And we were the ones that were there for the whole birth. So yeah, but that's amazing. I had that happen once. Somebody, a shaman once sang my song for me. I didn't know it was my song. He sang it and I was just crying. And I said, that was the most beautiful song I ever heard. And he said, that's because it's your song. And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to talk about singing too and music. You know, this happened in 2000. I was teaching spiritual readings and how to connect to the spirit. And so every week I would just be in a place and people could come if they were interested. I didn't have the same people or anything. I just did whatever. I just winged it because that's all there is to do anyway. and so these three women came. I had never met any of them. And they all were in a very needy place in their lives. And they said, well, can you do this for us every week? And I said, well, I can't do it here. I mean, you can come to my house, but I'm not coming up to Burlington. So we started this thing and we did it for 3 years. And it turned out that at one point, one of them was kind of like choking, like she couldn't speak. And I put my hand on her neck and it turned out that she was supposed to let music through. And all three of them were beautiful singers. And they started singing. It was like coming from heaven. And they wrote and they sang songs. I was just thinking about this last night. I was telling my friend, it ended up that over the years that we went to people who were ready to go and they were maybe in a coma, ready to pass over. And we would just sing, but it was kind of like toning. Or sometimes one of them would have a special message that was so beautiful for the person. And it usually worked. But here's a funny story. My writing teacher, who I just love, she was the age of my mom. And she was really sick. And so I took my students and we all went into the hospital and we sang to her like that. And there was another woman in her room who was also really sick. And they were both, you couldn't tell who, if someone was going to leave, you know? So we sang this whole thing to Marge, this person. And she ended up leaving the hospital and living another year, but her roommate left. I mean, it's just amazing because you don't know. I mean, you're just not in control. That's the thing. I mean, we're not in control here on the planet. It's not our thing. You know, if we let it come through and do what we're supposed to do, that's a whole different thing.
I wanted to ask, I mean, I would assume, maybe I'm assuming too much, but was it a very large honor to be able to attend those ceremonies as a white Westerner?
You know, they do it more now because they know they're going to make a little money from it. But at that point, yes, it was a big honor. Like I went to Mongolia for, let me see, I went up to the taiga for 5 years before they invited me to come to a ceremony. And so it's sort of like I had to know them a little bit because it really wasn't for me. You know, they're shamans for their family and they're close people. So the other is almost like a show if they do it for Westerners. They were usually doing it for some kind of healing purpose. Somebody that needed something or needed protection or their animals needed protection, or they did it each season. But to be allowed to go in, that's a big honor. I remember one time a few years ago, the son of one of the shamans that I used to know and the nephew, he's now the shaman and he's in his 20s. We got to his place and he said, well, there's this other family, this other tourist over here in that other orts who wants me to do a ceremony. But I said, I can't do it because it's not the right time of the month. And I said, okay, I don't think you should do it if it's not the right time. And he said, oh, no, Sass, you've come so far. We're going to do it. So he did a ceremony. And, you know, they couldn't get me because, you know, something you said in the beginning about how you feel about shamanism, just that you want to kind of understand it. That's how I am. I don't want them to do anything for me. I don't want to ask them any questions. I just want to see how someone else goes across the veil, you know, because I do that. And, you know, I do readings, spiritual readings, and connect with people's higher selves and things like that. I just wanted to see how other people did that. And I'm fascinated by it. So every single shaman that I met, I just thought that's what I was looking for. They'd always say, you don't have any questions? What is your question? I don't have any questions. I know how to connect and answer my own questions. Yeah. But sometimes they'd give me a message anyway. you know, yeah. So yes, it is an honor.
I think, you know, I just, maybe one of the reasons I'm so enchanted or enamored of, you know, shamanic healing, shamanic connection, shamanic conversation with the spirits and the world is because I think I hunger for that because, mm-hmm. you know, I know that to make this world a more beautiful place or to, you know, help another who is suffering or to reconcile someone's, I don't know, family or whatever kind of beautiful act can be brought into the world. I can't do it myself. Like I need the help of every spirit and angel that's out there. I mean, yeah. Tree spirit and, you know, maybe grass spirit or the river spirit. And there's also something really nourishing to my heart to know that I can be in close communion and I can be have deep friendship with these other living beings and that yeah. they have just as much of a right to exist as I do. And that, you know, after I'm long gone, or maybe even the whole human race is long gone, they will still be here and they will mm-hmm. still be, you know, surviving, thriving and just eternally beautiful.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of where I'm coming from as far as with my kind of endless quest for, you know, reading every myth under the sun, trying to understand culture. And, you know, I also blame my parents because I grew up overseas. So it's like, I just have this hunger.
Where did you grow up?
In Guyana in South America and then in Lahore in Pakistan.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, as a child, like you can imagine, I didn't get to see very much in either of those places because we were kept kind of sequestered away, but yeah. I would have to say, I was talking on a podcast the other day that the most beautiful place I've ever been is Kashmir because we got to spend a week on a houseboat there when they weren't fighting and at war for a brief. And I've never experienced such beauty in my entire life as Kashmir. It's like something out of some other reality, which, you know, I was 5 or 6 years old. And the fact that I can remember it so well, I think yeah. just it was just this insane experience for my senses that just was forever imprinted.
Wow.
Me. So, you know, I have this hunger, I think, as you were talking about, for just finding new ways. I mean, I'm always looking for new friends, right? So why can't that friend be a river?
Sure.
There's no reason it can't be a river.
Right.
As long as it doesn't want to borrow any eggs, I'm okay with it.
Borrow any what?
Eggs.
Eggs?
Yeah, like a neighbor coming over and saying, hey, do you have any eggs? And then you've got 2 eggs left and you think, oh, I should give these eggs to my neighbor because they need them. I don't really need them. Then I got to go to the store to get more eggs.
That's great.
I hope that you all enjoyed my conversation with Sass Carey. And I have to say that these interviews are really feeding my soul and my heart. And I hope that they're doing the very same for yours. I'm so grateful to Sass for agreeing to be on the podcast and for sharing about all the work she's doing and has done in Mongolia and the documentary films and books that she's created. I'm so grateful to her for preserving this way of life and for sharing that knowledge with all of us. To learn more about the work that she's done and that she's still doing, please do visit nomadichair.org. There will be a link in the episode show notes. And then check out some of the films that she's done and the books that she's written. The work that she's doing is so very important, and it's helping not only we who choose to check it out, but it's helping those who live in Mongolia, those nomads and the reindeer herders. She's helping to preserve a way of life, and she's helping to preserve knowledge of a way of life that is rapidly disappearing in that part of the world. I need to thank all of you for listening and for writing those ratings and leaving those reviews. They're so very important to me, and they help other people find us and find these stories of magic, these stories of miracles, these stories of ways of life that are happening all over the world. Please do consider checking out my YouTube channel. You can see my guests in all their glory telling their stories and find out a little bit more about them and who they are in the world. So thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Sass. Be open to the adventure. You never know when you travel in this world where it's going to take you, what kind of encounters you're going to have, what kind of fabulous stranger is just waiting to meet you. So be like Sass, be ready for the adventure, and when you find yourself in the middle of it, have faith and trust that this universe knows exactly where it's taking you. See you next week for another fabulous story, for another fabulous adventure, for another fabulous miracle. Because they're happening all around us to all sorts of people. And I have so many more amazing people that I can't wait for you to meet.
You know, interviewing the shamans is a very interesting thing, because since they don't call themselves shamans, it's like interviewing a regular person, sort of, but they've had other experiences. And then when they're the shaman, you're not going to interview them because they bring through someone else, one of their relatives or something, you know, so. I don't know if I'm clear on this, but, you know, I think of them as one person, whether they're a shaman, whether they're doing their shaman thing and bringing the ancestor in. I think of them as a person, but I don't think they do. They think they're just a regular old nothing, and then they're bringing the ancestor through their body. I don't know if that's clear, but.
So it's almost like they're channeling an ancestor who might have more knowledge or answers.
Or different knowledge. And I'll talk about channeling. I want to say there are two different ways in my experience. One is to be a medium and one is to be a channeler. You know, channeler, I'm still there. I let the energy come through. I speak. But a medium, you leave. And so sometimes when we've interviewed shamans, I remember my assistant said, you know, I'd like to ask a question. And she said to him, how do you feel before you do a ceremony? And he said, I'm scared because I never know what's going to come or what I'm going to need to do. So it's like a completely different thing. You know, you put that costume on and you aren't yet that your own person anymore. Whereas where my work is, I'm here all the time, you know, and okay, it's like being pregnant or something. You have another kind of energy going through you, but you're not that person. And I remember, did you ever hear of Rosalind Breer? She was a famous healer. She was a medium. And she talked about how it was to leave her body and just, you know, didn't really know what she would be made to do. Or I don't really do that. I sort of like a control freak. I like to know where I am.
It's actually very interesting. Before I started seminary, I read this great book called The Divine Horseman by Maya Deren. Are you familiar
with that?
Yeah, she was like a cultural anthropologist filmmaker who went to Haiti in like the 30s and 40s, I think. Okay. Anyway, she wrote this incredible book called The Divine Horseman, which just blew my mind. And is basically, she spent so much time down there and really just became embraced by the community and allowed to sit in on ceremony and worship services. And she describes, you know, the God comes in. This God comes in and mounts a human being. So the human being like loses who they are and then starts speaking through them.
Yes.
And dispensing wisdom, you know, advice, maybe ideas of something someone should do. And it's, you know, the people, they never know who's going to be ridden by the God. It's just everybody's in the ceremony, chanting, dancing. And like, who knows who's going to be the vessel for this God. And, you know, it sounds a little scary, but they're not scared because it's so normalized down there. It's totally normal. And each God has a different personality, a different way of being, likes different foods, different colors. Mm-hmm. But it's very obvious when the person gets mounted by the God. And then the God, you know, enjoys himself, herself, or themselves. And then they just depart, you know, when it's time, when they're maybe sick and tired of all the whining from the people or who knows. Yeah. And it's fascinating because she ends the book talking about what it feels like to be mounted because it happened to her. But there's like a place where she can't go any further because she loses all sense of self and consciousness. Right. So she has no idea what transpired and happened during those minutes where the God was in her. And I just think that that would be terrifying for me.
Yeah.
You know, so
it makes me think of two things. One is Quaker meeting, you know, that we were talking about before, where nobody knows who's going to be asked to speak. It could be anyone. It could come from any person because we don't have clergy. Or, you know, some Quaker places do, but ours isn't called a nun program. So that's one thing. The other thing is this whole issue of drinking, smoking, things that you do with your body when you're a shaman, when someone else has taken over your body and they want vodka or they want a cigarette. And I've had... I know there was one shaman I talked to, Yura, who wasn't, her health wasn't that great. And she was a year younger than I. And she was a shaman. I saw her do a ceremony, but she said sometimes she would just, one time she said to me, I had to take the year off because my health is not that good. And even though it's not me smoking or drinking vodka, I have to do it if I say yes to this. So, I mean, it's just an interesting thing when you're talking about mounting a body, you know, that stuff of alcohol and, you know, they do this, like, come here, like, give me, not, I can't get my hand in here, but yeah, they do this and they always have an assistant. So it's usually their wife or husband. And that person knows what that means and what to give them. But sometimes they might give them some milk. And they'll go, you know, or get really angry and then put their hand out again. No, I want the vodka, you know, and they don't say it. They just put their hand out and expect the vodka. So it's very, there's a lot I don't understand. You know, I'm just an observer of it because I'm not Mongolian. So I miss it. Sometimes one person, I think it might be the one we made the movie of. Everybody got a white strip and it was about having a wish or a question or something. And you tied it on the back of the ceremony and he wouldn't let me do it as a foreigner. So, yeah, had to be Mongolian, he said. Just interesting stuff, you know, that that I don't understand at all.
I have just one last question, and I'm just interested to see if you have anything to say about it. But in the cosmology of these herders, of the people living in Mongolia, do they believe that time is a circle, that everything repeats itself? I mean, how do they view death? Were you ever able to have conversations about that?
Yes, they believe in reincarnation. They believe even in what they call a mole. That means that somebody could have a birthmark that was their ancestor had the same birthmark and they came through as that ancestor. Like one of my really good friends, actually, who's on my board and went to Middlebury College, Mungjin, she explained this to me, that she had her uncle, I think, or aunt had died around when she was born, and they had the same kind of mole or birthmark. So they do believe in reincarnation. As far as when the shamans die, they take them out to the forest and leave them out there. And I have some good stories about that kind of thing. Like one person, the first person that told me a story about it said they had hung up the costume, this leather shaman costume, on a tree, and that it rained and then snowed, but there was a circle around it where it didn't snow.